Good morning and welcome to Friday Live here on NET Radio. Much of today's show is pre-recorded as we continue to protect ourselves and our guests from the spread of COVID-19. I'm Genevieve Randall. Two of Nebraska's orchestras have concerts this weekend and next. We'll learn more a little bit later in the show. Vision Maker Media is celebrating a milestone. That's just ahead. Plus, Heather Henson's Ibex Puppetry will be hosted by the Lead Center for Performing Arts. NET's William Padmore will have more about that performance a little bit later. We'll start our show this week with music. Hope Dunbar of Utica, Nebraska has a new album coming out titled Sweetheart Land. And we get to hear a track from that album right now here on Friday Live titled The Road Is. The Road Is, a track from a brand new album by Hope Dunbar. I'll talk with her right here in the studio in about 9 minutes, and we'll get to hear another track as well. This is Friday Live on NET Radio, online at netnebraska.org/radio. My next guests here this week are father and daughter, but also Frank Blythe is founding executive director of Vision Maker Media, created in 1976, and Francine Blythe Lewis is the current executive director. Across the generations, they've worked to lead an organization that is based here in Nebraska with a mission to share untold stories, stories of First Peoples all across the country. Vision Maker Media celebrates its 45th anniversary this year. And to celebrate, they're featuring a year-long selection of free community events. Frank and Francine are both here to talk about the past and the future of the organization. Welcome to Friday Live this week, you guys.
Hi.
Hi, good to be here.
Frank, I think we'll start with you, if you wouldn't mind talking about the origins of Vision Maker Media and its mission originally.
The origins of, at the time, called Native American Public Broadcasting Consortium, it actually started about 1974 when Ron Hull, Jack McBride, and a couple of other station managers around the country brought together a group of stations. And at the time, we found six other Native Americans working in public broadcasting as producers or filmmakers. We joined up together at the Wingspread Foundation in Wisconsin, spent 3 days discussing the possibility of forming an organization that could have some role in how public television gets Native American programming. We spent a whole afternoon together in deciding how to formulate a plan for this. It was our charge to come up with the plan. So they locked us in a room for about 6 hours. And we came out with what I thought was probably just a premise of a plan, a very skeleton plan, to become sort of a distribution house, first off. Long-term goals were to become a production house, a training house for Native Americans, and offer all kinds of services along that line. But those were a long time coming before we got around to doing that. The first thing was to find some startup money and get going. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting was also part of that meeting. And so they were involved from the beginning about how we were putting things together. And they asked us for a proposal after that. It took about another year, and we got some startup money to get going. And then was finding a place to stay. We had a lot of good support from Ron Hall of NET back then. He and Jack McBride thought it would be useful to offer their facilities and services at NET, which was back then was just a fairly new building, a fairly new complex.
Francine, one of the most recent successes for Vision Maker was the film festival, which received a Lincoln Arts Council Award for Outstanding Event here in August 2020. Over these 45 years, how has the organization changed?
It's gone more into the digital era for sure, because, you know, technology and the COVID-19 has taken us there on remote, more online. So what we did was we usually did the film festival in person every other year in Lincoln with various partners like the Mary Reitner Ross Theater and such. Last year with COVID and just not being able to do that, we decided to take it online. And to our surprise, and we didn't really calculate it in when we were trying to reach audiences, but it reached worldwide audience and really brought Native story, Native people, Native cultures to the forefront of world awareness among audiences everywhere. And so we are very, very proud of that fact. And so going forward, we've got to continue to dig deeper and dive deeper and program more within the online digital content and still continue strengthening our broadcast to PBS stations.
I'll pause for just a moment here to acknowledge that we have another generation here making some noise in the background with us, too. So in case listeners hear the little one sitting on your lap here, Francine. Well, so speaking of awards, something else that Vision Maker is involved in is something that is called the Frank Blythe Media Excellence Award. Tell us a little bit about that award.
It's been at our film festival that we've done it. So we didn't do it last year because we weren't in person. People acknowledge and recognize him as what we would call a path maker for Native media. That includes journalism, that includes radio, and that includes film and public media and broadcasting.
The media landscape is always changing, Francine. And when I am hearing you talk about what your father has done, about the Frank Blythe Award, the fact that you now have 45 years to celebrate going from those six people in that first meeting, what does the future look like?
We just got a $500,000 increase in our annual budget from CPB. That was announced just a few days ago by CPB nationwide, and we've been putting out the press on that throughout Indian Country media. And so we are really very excited about that. To me, one, it really extends, strengthens, and just deepens the commitment that CPB has in the work and the ability and the capability of what Vision Maker has been doing beginning in 1975 with my father and what he had started. I was in high school and we moved to Lincoln and my dad started then the Native American Public Consortium. He wanted to bring contemporary stories to PBS. And PBS kind of had the ideas of, you know, the Indian Wars, Indian chiefs, some Indian iconic leaders. And I remember a series on four contemporary Native artists, which was brand new to audiences, PBS and everything. And I guess I carry that forward from him, is like bringing Native stories of the now and what we're doing in our communities and in our cultures. We're not all about struggles. There's a lot of resilience. There's a lot of strength and overcoming of whatever the issues were back in the 70s. There's progressions made in that for social change and the betterment of Indian people and cultures. And that's part of what I want to continue to do, and also bring these stories into more platforms within PBS, creating co-productions, possibly, maybe even series, possibly. So that's what I have in mind with this $500,000 increase.
Vision Maker is hosting an online streaming event in celebration of Women's History Month coming up in March, too. Now, this is one of the many free events coming up this year since you are celebrating 45 years, and it's month-long. Do you want to give us an overview?
All year long, we're going to have different programmings, not every month, but Women's History, Environmental, in April, Indigenous Day, Native American Heritage Month, Veterans Day, and what we're doing is we're pulling from our archives some of the films over the past 45 years and putting them into a film programming content. And we're going to try to partner with different Native organizations to create panel topics around either like Women's History Month. We're doing a panel with in partnership with American Indians for Opportunity. They have four women leaders who've been doing work their career lives from their first trainings with AIO to transitions of change for society and culture. So, and we're doing something like that, you know, with Environmental Month and so on down the line.
Well, I've been talking here this morning with Frank Blythe and Francine Blythe Lewis, past and current directors for Vision Maker Media. They are celebrating 45 years this year as an organization, and there are a series of events planned in celebration, including the upcoming month-long series of films, free online, and we'll have links to more on the Friday Live page of our website. Frank and Francine, a huge congratulations on this milestone for Vision Maker Media.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Friday Live on NET Radio, online at netnebraska.org. Three Central Nebraska artists have recently decided to collaborate creatively.
What if three creative spirits got together and really kind of pursued what it meant to be creative? In the broader sense, how it impacts our relationships, how does it impact our journey through this thing of COVID? Is this something that brings us closer together when it comes to solving complex problems? Is this something that frankly creates division amongst us? Wouldn't it be a nice experiment?
Hear William Padmore's conversation with Artists Unanchored's Chris Huckstetler. That's on this week's Friday Live Extra podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or listen on our website at netnebraska.org/radio. You're listening to Friday Live, informing and inspiring Nebraska with unique programming. This is NET Radio. I'm Genevieve Randall. Next here on Friday Live, I'm joined by singer-songwriter Hope Dunbar. She was featured in the NET series Jam in 2020. And here in 2021, she is releasing a new album. Glad to welcome you back to the NET studios here, Hope.
Genevieve, it is so great to be here and to see you again. Thank you for having me.
You too, even through the shower curtain.
Even through the shower curtain. I love it.
Well, so your new album is titled Sweetheart Land. How did you come up with that title?
So that title was, that title predates the record, actually. It's a word that I had in my mind for a couple of years, and I thought, Sweetheart Land. I love it so much that I knew it was going to be something. At the time, I wasn't sure exactly what it would be. And thankfully, now we're on the finishing end of having created something that I love. It's called Sweetheart Land.
Yeah.
It's my new record.
I was just reading an article yesterday about words that can mean more than one thing or phrases that can mean more than one thing. So I really feel that there. The artwork on the cover is fun, too. It looks a little like tattoo art in a way.
It is tattoo art created by local tattoo artist Dave Robinson of Iron Brush Tattoo, not too far from here.
Yeah.
I had seen his work, and I knew I had a vision in my mind about something that was kind of a retro tattoo image for the cover, and Dave just knocked it out of the park. So I love what it looks like.
Well, Hope, if listeners heard the track that we played just a little bit earlier, the title of that track we played was The Road Is. And that phrase, The Road Is, ends up being the answer to kind of a number of questions you ask in the song. Mm-hmm. There's everything in there from the road being a kind of rescue to even an income source, or the road being an inspiration. So what sparked these ideas about the road in that song?
I'm definitely a traveler and a wanderer at heart. I do live in a small town, and I love that I've put down roots with my husband and three sons in this small town. But there's also a part of me that just has wanderlust for forever. I don't know if it'll ever go away. And so when it's time to get on the road, whether that be to go on vacation or to go play shows, I find a lot of inspiration and beauty and just discovery in the road. And I love the idea that the road can serve so many purposes and mean so many things to so many people, depending on your perspective. Right now, having been stuck for a year, the road sounds pretty great.
I was going to say, it's interesting to hear at a time when some people are traveling, but maybe doing it in a different way,
right,
or trying to just figure out how to do it in the first place.
Right.
So, yeah. And you mentioned you live in a small town. And I noticed in one spot on your website, you talk about how there's no noise where you live in Utica to get in the way of what you want to write about as you're creating. So I'll admit that I'm kind of drawn to that idea, too, of open space, of quiet spaces. So it's the travel, but then you seem to have this kind of yin-yang balance in your life with that place.
Well,
you've put down roots.
You. I like to think so, or at least I'm working on it. It's a work in progress. But yes, first, I love the beauty of this earth just in general, and the opportunity to see the beauty of creation and what people are like all over. I'm just super interested in that. I also know how blessed I am to be in the place where I live and like have that no noise background, because I do have a lot of artistic friends from all over the country who are living lives in very different places. And I know that, you know, there's a challenge to live in, for example, like Nashville, where there are a lot of artists and there are a lot of songwriters, and you could be tempted in a place like Nashville to constantly be looking over your shoulder, wondering who's writing what, or what's a selling, what's a hit, what does a hit sound like. And thankfully, I think that where we're at in our landscape, like Big Sky Country, Nebraska, we have this green light to create from a very true place, from a very authentic place, where because there aren't as many artists, you know, consolidated in one small area, we have the ability to really follow what's inspiring to us, not necessarily reading the room or taking the temperature of what the marketplace is asking us to create.
Absolutely. So you're finding more of an organic inspiration then, is what I'm hearing you say.
That's how I would describe, where the kind of the root of what I write and why I write it and from what place I write it would be, of this big empty canvas that we're blessed to have.
Yeah. When were you writing and producing this new album?
So a lot of the music from this album, actually, this is an album where there are songs that represent years back. I've had some songs on this record that first I actually chose to reproduce. So tracks like Woman Like Me and Dust on this record were first produced and released on previous records, and I felt like this was a time where I wanted to revisit some of these songs and give them kind of the treatment I'd always dreamed they could have on this record. But then there's stuff as soon as, I believe the last song written for this record was the title track, Sweetheart Land. And Sweetheart Land clocked in like the summer of 2018 and well, maybe summer of 2019, and we recorded at Christmas time, around Christmas time of December 2019.
I saw the song John Prine on there, and I thought you had either played it on Friday Live once, or maybe you sent us the track or something. And then, of course, we lost John Prine in this last year to COVID-19. So that's interesting to see on this album, too, for me.
And for me, too, because when I wrote that song, it was out of, like, deep admiration and appreciation for the work that he'd given us. And knowing that I had this album in the can when John Prine passed away due to complications from COVID, I was devastated. Like, I really felt emotional, not just from COVID shutting everything down, but then it felt like a second blow. Like, I didn't like release this song out into the universe while he was still with us. And I felt terrible about that. Not that I know John Prine or that we have a relationship, but it was something I wanted to just offer to him in his lifetime. And then I got really worried about whether I should release it after his death. And now that the record's done, I'm very happy that I have that, because I hope that people hear it and know that I really loved his work. I really honor his memory and all of the things he gave us in his lifetime, which were so beautiful. I know how much it meant to me. And I hope the song helps people think about what John Prine did for them, too.
Yeah, I think a lot of singer-songwriters really look to John Prine and admire his work and are inspired by him. We're going to hear another track from the album that's called More. What's the story behind that song?
So I think I've got a running theme on every record that there's going to be something rather autobiographical. And so if on Three Black Crows, my last record, the autobiography was a song called I Write, this is the new autobiography called More. And this is a song I've had for a few years. I play it a lot in live shows. I never thought about recording it until I started working on this project. And I thought, this song goes with this collection of pieces, and I was glad to be able to have it part of Sweetheart Land.
All right. Well, Hope Dunbar's new album, again, is Sweetheart Land, and the official release date
is Friday, April 2nd.
Friday, April 2nd. So you're getting a bit of a sneak peek here.
That's right.
And we're going to hear the track titled More from that album next here on Friday Live. Hope, thanks for talking with me.
Genevieve, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. This is Friday Live here on NET Radio.
Pick up my guitar and sing. I write down a few words. Pick up my guitar and sing.
That's from Hope Dunbar's newest album, Sweetheart Land, a track titled More, here on NET Radio's Friday Live. Still to come on Friday Live, poetry from Greg Kosmicki, and we'll have highlights from our arts calendar, plus William Padmore talks with puppeteer Heather Hansen about her Lead Center performance.
Next here on Friday Live, Kearney Symphony Orchestra has a concert on March 2nd. That is this coming Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. on the UNK campus.
Conductor and music director Allison Gaines joins me to talk about the concert. It's great to talk with you again, Allison.
Yeah, great to hear you again.
Let's talk about the repertoire for this concert. It looks like mostly, if not all, American composers.
Yeah, sort of like pretty much like last year, too. I feel like February is, you know, commemorates some very important aspects of, certainly to me anyway, of American history, including Black History Month. So figured I'd celebrate the American composers. I know we have President's Day in here. That's one reason last year we did Lincoln Portrait. This year we're focusing, our subtitle is From Sea to Shining Sea. So we do have Gershwin. It's sort of the concert, sort of a Gershwin sandwich. We've got Gershwin, who represents New York. We've got a fellow named John Steinmetz, who's from Los Angeles. And then we did throw in a French composer named Pierre Dubois. And one of the Gershwin pieces is American in Paris.
So there's a tie in there between Paris and the U.S.
You betcha.
I know, too, some of those French composers had a great admiration for a lot of styles of American music, including jazz.
Oh, yeah. When you hear Ravel's G major piano concerto, you can hear it so much in there. It's fantastic. And, you know, it's kind of supporting that. The piece we're playing by Pierre Dubois is a concerto for alto saxophone. And we have a concerto aria competition every year. And a really talented young man, one named Jacob Cahill. Jacob was actually getting principal saxophone in Allstate when he was a sophomore in high school. So,
wow.
So lucky to have students like that here. He's also the orchestra's second oboist, and I have seen him play flute very well as well. So we're really happy to feature him and to feature this interesting piece. It's a really nice piece of music for sax and strings.
Well, I also want to hear a little bit about this Steinmetz, because I don't think many people are familiar with that name.
We're opening with the strings doing the Gershwin Lullaby, which is just an adorable piece of music. And then something by Norman we all want to say De La Hoyo, but apparently it's De La Joyo. But then we do the Dubois, then the strings exit. We do a short aerosol break. It's always short after the strings. And then we do the Steinmetz, three pieces for 10 instruments. I just stumbled upon this piece because we've been doing instrument families all year to keep, you know, things small and try and still keep it simple. So I was starting to feel like I was running out. Maybe if I were a wind player, I would have more things in my holster. But I just started surfing around YouTube, and I stumbled upon this piece, and I love it. I think it's sort of eclectic. I did talk to him at length about it. And the first movement reminds me a little bit of Messiaen, but maybe I say that because it's got a lot of bird call moments in it, you know. That gives way to these sort of blocks of sound, chord blocks that remind me a little of Varese. So both of those guys were French composers and early 20th century. It's a little more tonal than that, though. But most things are a little more tonal than Varese. But don't get me started on him. but at any rate, the second movement begins with almost a reference or homage to Dvorak's Wind Serenade. It has a little bit of the same rhythms in it. It has that way that Dvorak kind of just blossoms the wind section, where they just build, and then just, you know, flower out. So he has that beautiful type of writing in it. And then in a way that I know it sounds disparate, like they don't fit together. But he very skillfully goes into a sort of minimalist texture in the second movement after that. And it's really smooth, these changes. Then that segues into the last movement, which I can only describe that melody as like kind of a little pop tune that he treats contrapuntally. It's really charming, really charming. So the piece starts challenging and moves to charming over a period of about, you know, 18 minutes. But terrific stuff. I love it.
Well, so with all of that in mind, it sounds like a really great variety of styles and of sounds. Are audiences going to be in person for this or streamed online? How are you handling that?
We're letting the players each invite two people if they want. Our capacity, you know, luckily not everybody can bring someone. So our capacity now with COVID is only about 85 people in this 400-seat hall. So we're just giving the players tickets. There won't be any box office. Our plan originally was to do the same thing that we did in November, where on the 5-10 minute aerosol break after the strings, we play a little something short, interview, then between winds and brass, which has to be more like 20-25 minutes, we play some more interviews so that when people are looking at the, instead of a blank stage while we clear out, they have something to listen to. And I think we had a photo montage last time too. But we're actually having some technical difficulties with our network, and I'm not sure if it's going to stream or not. But we did record the interviews, though, with John Steinmetz, with our soloist, Jacob Cahill, and one with me. And if all else fails, we will put these on our Facebook page.
It's not often that you get to actually talk to a composer, though, these days. So that is certainly something. Well, how are you planning the rest of the season, then, for Kearney Symphony Orchestra?
Well, we had already reserved the Merriman Theater in town, which is more of a community theater space or city space. And it has a larger stage. So the last concert is going to be the first time that we are combining to any real extent, winds, brass, and percussion. I had my engineer brother, I gave him a handwritten chart on a grid, and he had mentioned that he had a program through his work that would arrange this for me in 6-foot, you know, a diagram. So I'm looking at it right now, and other than one percussionist who's going to be half off the stage, we can fit. So we are going to do Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet at a safe distance. We will also be premiering a work that we commissioned from a composer here on our staff named Anthony D'Onofrio, and I cannot wait for that. We're also going to feature another concerto aria winner with the last movement of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto and probably a brass fanfare opening.
Allison Gaines is music director and conductor for Kearney Symphony Orchestra and assistant professor of orchestra and bass at UNK, University of Nebraska Kearney. The Kearney Symphony gives a concert Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Allison, it's great to talk to you and have a great concert.
Thank you.
Serving your community anywhere that might be, NET Radio is Nebraska's public radio network. Online, netnebraska.org. Be sure to check out the arts calendar on our website. There are online-only or other socially distant events there, in addition to some in-person. Feel free to submit your own arts or humanities event. That address to find events or add your own is netnebraska.org/radio. Just click events. Here's some highlights. The show Art While Masked is a pop-up student art show held in the Chadron State College Memorial Hall Main Gallery now through April 2nd. Sunday in Wayne, A Touch of Brass gives a concert in Ramsey Theater on the Wayne State College campus. The concert also streams online starting at 2 p.m. And the Minden Opera House Gallery opens a show Tuesday by origami artist Linda Steven called Nebraska Outdoors in Origami. For more information about these and other events, visit our website, netnebraska.org/radio.
Support for humanities-related programming on NET comes from Humanities Nebraska, delivering opportunities to engage with history and culture. On the web at humanitiesnebraska.org.
Support for programming also comes from the Archway in Kearney, spanning I-80 at exit 275. The Archway tells the stories of the pioneers who helped to build America. The Archway is open year-round. For information, archway.org. And History Nebraska, recognizing everyday Nebraskans who do their part to preserve and share Nebraska's stories. The history of Nebraska belongs to the people. To learn more, history.nebraska.gov. This is the time when you have to get out of your car and you're feeling that pain that you might miss something. Don't worry. We podcast the show each week, and you can look for that later this afternoon on our Facebook page or on our website. The address is netnebraska.org. Ahead in about 14 minutes, we'll get a preview of how Lincoln Symphony Orchestra is giving their next concert this evening.
I'm Dave Hughes. Nebraska poet Greg Kosmicki is a retired social worker who founded the Backwaters Press in 1997. Kosmicki reads two of his poems this week on Friday Live.
I've written many poems about my family, and these are two about my parents. Saturday. Saturday, the doctor said we could bring her home, so we did. And Saturday, she sat with us in her chair, voices swirling around her. And the bodies, all part of her creation, hers and Dad's, all of us there because of them. And Saturday, later we would talk about just that and what we all could do. Saturday, she lasted long enough to eat two bites of an Arby's sandwich, then demanded to return to the hospital, exhausted. And Saturday, our mother lay down, fully clothed in her hospital bed, as she has never done in her adult life, because she was too tired for anything else, for changing, not even to take off her nylon socks that were cutting off her circulation. And Saturday, her two living sons and one of her daughters lay her down onto the hospital bed, and she sank far, far down into the blankets and pillows, a mirage, a puff of cake flour. And Saturday, I saw my mother's face look back at me as if she would not see me again, her little head wrinkled and shrunken up as a dried rosebud. And Saturday, we kissed our mother back into sleep. She needed more than she needed us. And Saturday, I looked at her, and she seemed almost to disappear. And Saturday, I remembered that smile on her face, just in case, how her thin arms reached around my neck, and Saturday, how her hands patted my back, hands thin as communion hosts, light as the touch of a small bird's wing. Sitting in a concrete parking garage at lunchtime to eat some raviolis out of a plastic container that one time held sour cream, or what passes nowadays for sour cream, I see the grain of the plywood the workers used to make their forms when they poured this thick wall in front of me. And I see on the post that supports the ceiling some numbers written in pencil, probably 2 by one of the workers, when they constructed this garage. And the numbers written on the post make me think of my father as numbers penciled in on any piece of construction always do. For as a child, I watched him work, hanging sheetrock, nailing studs together, framing, building something permanent, as I have never bothered to learn how to do. And I remember the magic that he could take out his pencil and make numbers that would eventually be boarded in and not seen forever. And the power, too, that went with being one with permission to write things down on places where it was forbidden for me to do so. Now, 40 years later, I'm sitting in a car in a concrete garage, close, I hope, to the middle of my life, while he nears the end of his, with one thing after the other going wrong. Like an old house you work on, but never can finish, because when you get one thing done, two more things fall apart. But when they do, and it's your body, you can't open it up, tear off an old set of lungs like cupboards from the kitchen wall, knock the skin open like plaster, find the secret calculations someone left there that explain how they reached this exact configuration, how many yards of arteries, the exact spacing of the bones like studs, the number of feet of capillaries calculated by hand with a rectangular yellow pencil when your body was new construction, all the work done on it still known by heart.
Greg Kosmicki just read Sitting in a Concrete Parking Garage, and before that, Saturday. Kosmicki lives in the Omaha area with his wife, Debbie.
More with Friday Live, and this time I am joined by founder of Ibex Puppetry, Heather Henson, to talk about the virtual panel she did with Lead Center Executive Director Bill Steffen on her latest show, A Zizek on Turtle Island. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the event. I understand it's not the actual show, but a panel discussion about A Zizek on Turtle Island. What can audiences expect?
It's going to be a presentation of a number of the creators that made the show came together for this live interactive Q&A question and demonstration. So I'm there with a number of the puppets from the show. I have a bison and a crane and a number of puppets, and Ty is there to talk about the themes and the story structure. And then Dawn Avery is there, and actually she brings her cello and she teaches us all a song. It's a great chance to come together and talk about this show because, well, we were originally supposed to bring the show to the Lead in March this year. And unfortunately, because of COVID, we couldn't bring it. But we are going to bring it next spring, 2022. So this is just our opportunity to engage with the amazing audiences that are in Lincoln, Nebraska. We love coming to Nebraska every spring for the crane migration. And we were all looking forward to doing this show. And so we can't bring the show, but we can bring this panel discussion instead.
This one centers around the crane migration. I'm just kind of curious, where did you first get your fascination for the crane migration?
Well, cranes are these ancient, beautiful, magical animals. They have been migrating up and down these flyways across the planet. There are 15 species of cranes around the world, and we here in North America have two of them, the two best. We have the sandhill crane and the whooping crane, and they've been flying on these flyways, like I said, for millions of years. They're so fascinating and beautiful and wonderful, and then there's stories to be told about them. So I engaged with Ty Defoe a number of years ago, and he is Anishinaabe. His nation has a lot of connections to cranes because his area, his original territory, is all where a number of cranes nest, their nesting grounds. So there's a lot of crane connections up there and crane clan up there. The story is about a little crane born in Wood Buffalo, Canada, and flying, making her first migration down the central flyway through Nebraska, on through the Platte River, down to the coast of Texas. And then she has to make this migration. In our story, she had separated from her parents, and she has to make it on by her own, on her own, learning from the animals and the people and the plants and the waterways that she meets along the flyway.
And I understand there's going to be a special presentation within this panel, a little shout out to Nebraska.
Yes, indeed. So the show, we talk about a lot of scenes where the crane lands. And of course, we had to have these cranes land in Nebraska. We had to have the cranes land on the Platte River. So in this scene, we actually envision the crane landing on a cornfield on the banks of the Platte River and meeting the First Nations people who were there growing their corn. So in this case, they meet a woman. It's an actor. In our case, Joan Henry is the actress, but she's playing a nod to the Pawnee community who are originally up the Platte River, and they have been doing such a good job restoring their corn. So we kind of do an homage to the great work that the Pawnee Nation and the Pawnee Seed Preservation Group is doing to restore their corn. So there's some nods to that in the scene, and we included that in the video. So please, in the program, so please watch that.
And you've dropped a few names already. Do you just want to kind of go through who everyone is and sort of what they do in the production?
The people on the panel were myself, Ty Defoe, the author, Dawn Avery, the composer, but also I want to put out a nod to the other composers, Kevin Tarrant, very important presence in art and making our show, and then Larry Mitchell is another composer. And then plus the show couldn't have been, it was created with an amazing cast and puppet builders and technicians and artistry. So many people came together to make the show. But in the panel, it's Ty and Dawn and myself.
Now, this is a puppet show, and I can tell just from the stills and the trailer that I've seen that it is quite an experience. But can you tell me a little bit about your company, Ibex? Yes, you do puppet shows, but there is sort of like a wider message to these shows, isn't there?
The puppet company that I started, Ibex Puppetry, was making puppet shows always about environmental issues and trying to find this balance on how to live on the planet. And so there's always usually elements of education and environmental awareness in the shows. And in the making of the puppets, we also try to get some of that messaging across in how we make the puppets. These puppets in this particular show, because the crane is going to all these different areas on the flyway, we try to make the puppets look like they're coming from that environment. So we have a deer that looks like he's coming out of the birch bark forest, and we have buffalo that look like he's coming out of the tall prairie grasslands. And so there's an element of like trying to draw upon the material of the animal. And then that goes into lots of my philosophy of even working with puppets. I do like the world of puppetry and mask because you can get in touch with those areas that you're trying to embody.
And I guess final question for you, it has been one heck of a year for pretty much everyone on the planet. I'm sure you included. How have you been? And then what do you sort of see going forward in the future for Ibex?
So after this COVID time has been a very contemplative time for our company. We've pivoted a ton of our programs to Zoom and online and outreaching through this technology of the internet. Personally, I've gone inward and I'm doing quiet contemplations of connecting to nature. The company itself, it is really hard to know what we're going to do. I know we are excited to be in Nebraska in 2022, which is a long time away. It's still pretty unknown trying to make plans in the future. We're mainly making our plans in film. That stuff, that is a little easier to manage. And we do have, so I can promote something that's coming up. Oh, wait, it's going to go on. Wait, yes, I can promote something. We did a whole series of puppet films that were made in quarantine. So we commissioned a number of artists to make films in the quarantine of their own homes. And we have about 10 of those are coming out on Saturday.
Puppet films made in quarantine.
Yeah.
Where can people go to find that?
That's on Saturday night. We're doing it. That's on Saturday. We're promoting that. That's going to be Saturday night on our Facebook account.
I have been talking with Heather Henson, founder of Ibex Puppetry, about the upcoming virtual lead center panel discussion about her show, Ajijax on Turtle Island, an epic puppet show about the crane migration. Ms. Henson, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Also coming to the lead, Behzad Abdurayimov performs. That'll be Sunday, February 28th at 4 p.m. Central, with the option for audiences to attend in person or virtually. I'm William Padmore with Friday Live.
I'm Genevieve Randall, and you're listening to Friday Live, streaming online at netnebraska.org. A couple who tried and failed to start a family together are living together again in South Dakota. The novel, The Leave Takers, they struggle to get their lives together, moving forward, perhaps together. On this week's All About Books, host Pat Leach talked with author Stephen Wingate about the long journey to create the novel and why writers put themselves through it.
Most people who become artists are not just kind of, you know, happy-go-lucky and carefree. Most people who become artists do so because there's some things they have to figure out. And for me, writing has been the path to some sort of, not necessarily understanding, but at least an articulation of the problems that that have vexed me and shaped me.
Hear more from author Stephen Wingate about his new novel, The Leave Takers, just published by the University of Nebraska Press. It's online at netnebraska.org/allaboutbooks. Next here on Friday Live, Lincoln Symphony Orchestra has a concert tonight, and again, it is streamed online. Now, last time the concert featured some chamber ensembles made up of orchestra members, but this time the orchestra are together on stage with music by Mozart and Strauss. One of the Mozart works is a concerto featuring pianist Anne Chang, and she joins me now here on Friday Live, along with LSO Executive Director Barbara Zockley. It's great to see you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The concert is streamed at 7:30 p.m., but if you join early, there is a pre-concert chat at 6 p.m. in which viewers will also get to meet guest conductor Delta David Geyer. So, Barbara, the orchestra, I mentioned, is on stage at the Lead Center there with a guest conductor. So what can viewers expect to see? Are the musicians masked? Are they spaced apart?
We're taking every precaution. When we say the orchestra, it is representatives from every family of the orchestra, but just in smaller numbers. So where you normally might see 70 players, I think we have 27 or 28 on stage tonight. They're farther apart. The Lead Center, I think, has actually a 6-foot pole that they can use to measure the distance between. And our brass players have what looks like kind of black shower caps on the end of their instruments, even get a mask. It's called a bell cover, and they're wearing masks that have like offset slits so that they can get the mouthpiece in. I have to say, this orchestra is family to each other and to our community, and we have to, number one, prioritize being safe and doing this as carefully and thoughtfully as we can. Tied for number one is to make music together. Just a very special thing to have the orchestra together on stage. And there were a lot of full hearts this week being together.
NET Radio has been featuring some weekly calls with various conductors from around Nebraska, as so many have not been able to meet with their orchestras over this time. Ed Polichick was my guest for those conductor house calls every Monday in February from his home in Baltimore. And since he still can't travel right now, you have this guest conductor. So, Barbara, maybe tell us a little bit about David Geyer.
Sure. He is just a fabulous conductor. Many of our orchestra members have actually played under his baton before. He's the music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. And so he was able to get in his car and safely drive down here to be with us this weekend. It was just lovely of him to be available and to come in. It's always, I think, intimidating to come in front of a new group of musicians, even more so when they're playing farther apart than normal, under different circumstances than they've ever played before. And he has just stepped in and done such a lovely job preparing the orchestra for this concert.
There's a Richard Strauss work that Lincoln Symphony Orchestra will be presenting, the Serenade for 13 Winds, and then a couple of pieces by Mozart, the ever popular A Little Night Music, as well as a concerto. And Anne Chang, you are the soloist on that. Many listeners may remember you. What's the character of this Mozart concerto? He wrote a few.
So the fact that the key is in D minor, I think already tells you that it's a pretty dramatic piece. Yeah, doesn't really write much in minor, but when he writes in D minor specifically, that's serious. That's the Requiem, that's Don Giovanni, that's this piece. But there's a lot of happiness in this piece as well, which I think is really very timely for right now.
And looking back over this past year, what's it like for you getting to plan and play a concerto with an orchestra?
The performing musicians can tell you that it's been awful to not be in front of an audience. Some of our listeners miss live performances, but we miss it as much, if not more, because that's what we devoted our lives to. So to not have live performances, I don't do as many as some of my colleagues do, so it's been better. To have this to look forward to and to prepare for it has been a real blessing for me.
How do you prepare for a concert like this?
The rehearsals, thankfully, we got a couple with the symphony, and you know, we are all professionals and have done this a few times. So that part of it is pretty standard, except that what Barbara mentioned, the spacing apart has been very difficult for us. You know, musicians, our bread and butter is our ears, and it's what we hear.
And your breath. Musicians are used to being close enough together that they can actually take a breath together, and that's harder to do when you're in a mask and you can't see a mouth and you can't hear in the same way.
It's the organic body that works as one. When we have ourselves spread apart for obvious reasons like this, it does make it much more difficult for us to be ensemble, to think more ensemble way for the auditory. So that's been a little difficult, but all of us, congratulations to LSO, for all of us to make that work and be using our skills to make sure that that mitigation doesn't make it too difficult for us. But it is something different from our usual layout. So we are getting used to that very new format.
When we see these musicians on stage during this stream, what I think of as a musician myself is how people have stayed motivated to play and practice over this last year when goals and deadlines are completely different and you may not have a concert coming up. And what have you done over this last year to stay motivated?
Many times the motivation is really intrinsic. We are musicians because we want to make music. The concert is, of course, a wonderful byproduct of that and something that we do look forward to. But many times we practice and play for our benefit. I've been finding myself going to the piano a lot more often than I would have in a normal situation. The piano has been like a salve for me during this very difficult year, and really gotten to appreciate its role in my life even more. So there's been a lot of that kind of playing on my part.
I read a blog post from pianist Stephen Huff. He kind of talked about it as if he were a monk, he said, is how he felt. He had this routine where he was allowed to take a walk and he would go to his studio and practice piano. And it felt like this meditation for him. And then he would walk back home and that would be his routine every day.
Yeah.
I think if music wasn't personally fulfilling for the players in our orchestra, they wouldn't be doing it. It's wonderful to be with an audience. But I think the more special thing this week has just been the being together. Because you can play your instrument alone in your home, but having that community aspect, an orchestra is a community, has been the real sorrow for these musicians over the last year, is you can find that salvation in music on your own, but it's very different than the community part.
Well, we're definitely looking forward to Anne Chang playing some Mozart. She has been my guest here along with Lincoln Symphony Orchestra's executive director, Barbara Zach Lee. And indeed, Anne is featured on that Mozart concerto along with Lincoln Symphony Orchestra playing some Strauss and another Mozart work tonight, streaming online. And we will have a link to more on the Friday Live page at netnebraska.org/radio. I will be guiding a pre-concert chat, so if you join the online stream at 7 p.m. with Anne, Barbara, as well as guest conductor Delta David Geyer, and the concert starts at 7:30 p.m. Anne and Barbara, thank you again. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Genevieve.
And this is Friday Live here on NET Radio online, netnebraska.org. A new exhibition that focuses on the guitar is now showing in Omaha. KVNO's Corbin Hirschhorn has the details.
The Durham Museum's exhibition showcases one of the world's favorite musical instruments, the guitar. Guitar, the instrument that rocked the world, comes to Omaha from the National Guitar Museum in New York and explores the history, science, and cultural significance behind the instrument. Jessica Brummer, Director of Communications at the Durham Museum.
I think this exhibition does a really good job of not only appealing to maybe the music fan or those that are, you know, players of the guitar, but also looking at how an instrument has evolved over time. So the show starts with really the very first string instruments developed by ancient cultures, you know, 3000 BC, kind of the first music making instruments. And then explores how that instrument has changed over time with things like electricity and pop culture influences. So I think that people will learn a lot about history and culture and maybe science of sound, in addition to seeing some really cool artifacts and really cool guitars that are on display.
Fans of the guitar will be treated to some unique and memorable pieces in the collection.
Yeah, there's quite a few very interesting pieces. There's over 70 guitars in the show, so there's a lot to look at. A couple notable ones. Well, the oldest one in the show is from 1806, so, you know, we're talking about some pretty old pieces in there. The show has the world's largest playable guitar, so it is 43 and a half feet long and stretches pretty much the whole center of the gallery, and you can play it. Other unique things, the guitar with eight necks, which is the most in the world. It's playable as well, not by guests, but by those that developed the instrument. One of B.B. King's guitars is in the show. So there's a lot of variety. There's also a lot of kind of interactives throughout the show that maybe help people understand the design or the sound, those kinds of things. So we're noticing that kids are having a lot of fun with that too. So I think it is a good exhibit to kind of bring the whole family to.
In conjunction with the guitar exhibit, the Durham Museum is highlighting the local community and partnering with the Omaha Conservatory of Music.
Yeah, so something we like to do with these temporary exhibitions is always, you know, try and make a local tie. We've done that a couple ways with this show. One, you'll see throughout the gallery when you're in the guitar exhibit, giant murals of local musicians playing guitars. So that's just a fun way for us to highlight some of our local creatives and shine a light on their work. But also, we developed a small companion show with the Omaha Conservatory of Music. It sits in the gallery right next to the guitar exhibit. And it is all about how you can make instruments at home with things that you have and developing different sounds with different items that might be around your house. So that show is called Instrumental. Again, there's fun things like an 8-foot long rain stick that kids can play with, a Cajun drum circle. So I think it provides a good relevance for the show and tying it to a partner organization in Omaha. So it's a great way for families and kids to maybe understand and get their hands on some of these different concepts that we're talking about in the larger exhibition.
Guitar, The instrument that rocked the world is on display at the Durham Museum until April 25th. Due to COVID-19, registration online is required. For more information, go to durhammuseum.org. For Friday Live, I'm Corbin Hirshhorn.
Coming up this morning on NET Radio, classical music, and this afternoon, Laura Black with Classics by Request. Be sure to visit the NET website for podcasts of the show at netnebraska.org/radio. Portions of Friday Live are pre-recorded. Our theme music was written and performed by Alexios Anist. Thanks to everyone who makes Friday Live possible, including Carrie Meese, William Padmore, and associate producer Dave Hughes. I'm Genevieve Randall. Support for programming on NET Radio comes from the Glencore School of Music at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, celebrating 125 years nurturing the creativity, artistry, and scholarship of Nebraska students in music and dance. Information about upcoming performances and applications to become a student at the Glencore School of Music at music.unl.edu.